I've entitled our talk this evening, Evolution Religion and the Genesis Account. The recently concluded McLean versus Arkansas creation evolution trial was widely heralded in the media as a confrontation between science and religion, a virtual reenactment of the Scopes trial. Religion, it was suggested, again came off the loser in a contest between religious dogmatism and scientific objectivity. Not so prominent in media reports was the fact that both sides of the controversy had their own scientists and theologians. Although many in the creationist camp are aware that there are scientists who support creationism, this knowledge does not seem to reach the public with any clarity. Creationists probably also realize there are theologians who are evolutionists, though it is doubtful that many are aware of the number and influence of such people. This latter point is our concern here. In fact, 2/3 of the plaintiffs in the Arkansas suit who protested teaching creation science in the public schools were, quote, ministers or other leaders in Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish organizations, unquote. These religious leaders included, quote, the resident Arkansas bishops of the United Methodist, Episcopal, Roman Catholic, and African Methodist Episcopal churches, a principal official of the Presbyterian churches in Arkansas, and other United Methodist, Southern Baptist, and Presbyterian clergy, unquote. The Jewish plaintiffs were the American Jewish Congress, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, and the American Jewish Committee. If this trial was really a struggle between science and religion, why were there so many religionists on the anti-religion side? In fact, the trial was not basically a matter of science versus religion, but to a significant degree, a struggle between two kinds of religion, as well as between two kinds of science, between what we may call creation religion and evolution religion, as well as between creation science and evolution science. It is not our intention in this paper to consider the issues raised in the trial, whether creation science is a science. Indeed, it is, by at least one reasonable definition of science. Nor shall we consider to what extent it is correct science. It seems to me it's mistaken in regard to the age of the earth. Nor do we wish to consider some of the tactical mistakes made in drawing up and passing a law which appeared to limit the creation model to a young earth view only. Instead, let us consider where the religionists who attack the law are coming from. Are they believers in evolution religion? If so, what is this evolution religion? How is evolution religion related to the religion taught in the Bible? Is evolution religion really true? I might add, by way of aside, that there's a fairly nice summary, and with considerable detail even, of some of the things that went on in the Arkansas creation evolution trial. This work put together by Norman Geisler, which has considerable summary of the actual testimony on both sides and the full transcript of the judge's decision and considerable material regarding the media report of the material as headlines and articles from quite a few major newspapers. The title of this work is Norman Geisler's The Creator in the Courtroom, Scopes 2. You may find that worthwhile picking up a copy of that. What is evolution religion? To start with, let us admit that the name evolution religion was invented for this paper, so far as we know. You may see from the remarks above that it's obviously a parallel on creation science. Nevertheless, the phenomena to which it refers really exists. The name is designed to draw attention to the fact that evolution is a crucial part of the belief system of the religion held by a number of the plaintiffs and their witnesses in the Arkansas trial. Most people who are familiar with the terms Marxism and secular humanism realize that these modern ideological systems are based upon evolution as one of their foundations. Likewise, some religions unrelated to Judaism and Christianity are founded on, or at least compatible with evolution, Baha'ism, Hinduism, for instance. All these systems might be categorized as evolution religions. Not so well known to the average person, religious or not, is the fact that liberal versions of Christianity and Judaism are also strongly tied to evolutionary thinking, so that they too are evolution religions. So theological liberalism in Jewish and Christian circles actually predates Darwin's Origin of Species. Evolution quickly became an important part of liberal theology in the late 19th century after Darwin's work appeared. The growth of liberal theology in Protestantism led to a showdown with Bible believers during the first decades of the 20th century in the so-called fundamentalist modernist controversy. The fundamentalists claim that certain doctrines of the Bible are basic or fundamental to biblical Christianity, and that modernists, by denying these, were teaching heresy. These so-called fundamental doctrines were, 1, belief in the miraculous, 2, the deity, and 3, the virgin birth of Jesus, 4, his payment for mankind's sin by dying on the cross, 5, his second coming, and 6, the complete accuracy of the Bible on all subjects it mentions. The modernists claimed that these beliefs were ancient superstitions and not necessary to modern Christianity. Although the evolution question was not mentioned in the so-called fundamentals, it figured prominently in the debate, even though not all fundamentalists rejected it. Perhaps it is not surprising that the original Scopes trial also occurred at this time. The upshot of the fundamentalist-modernist controversy was a political and ecclesiastical victory for the modernists, who gained control of most of the mainline denominations, their publishing houses, mission boards, colleges, and seminaries. This is why we see officers of these mainline denominations as plaintiffs in the Arkansas trial, and why Roland Fry, in his recent book, Is God a Creationist?, can maintain, quote, "The essays gathered here analyze a creationist controversy calmly and judiciously, appraising it in the light of how major religious leaders, scholars, and mainstream denominations understand the doctrines of divine creation in the Bible and in religious tradition." Unquote. Though fundamentalism appeared to be mortally wounded by the mid-30s, it did not die as predicted for its failure to accept the so-called facts of modern science. On the contrary, liberal churches have been the ones losing membership since then, and the conservative church is growing. Church growth, of course, does not prove one has the truth, but this increase in evangelical Christianity has probably been one of the factors in the recent revival of the creation-evolution controversy. However, theological liberalism and fundamentalism may have fared since the 30s. Our concern here is to understand how it is that so many of the plaintiffs against teaching creation science in Arkansas are religious leaders. The answer, we suggest, is that liberal theology is an evolution religion, and it doesn't want any competition from creation religion in the public schools. One of the main points of dispute in the fundamentalist-modernist controversy was the occurrence of miracles. The fundamentalists lined up behind the historical accuracy of biblical miracles. The modernists denied that miracles really occur. This liberal position may be seen in any work which discusses the question, though the subject is often ignored today as being long settled. We cite 3 important liberal works here. One of the prominent early advocates of liberalism was Adolf Harnack, professor of church history at the University of Berlin at the turn of the century. In his influential work, What is Christianity?, Harnack writes, quote, "Miracles, it is true, do not happen, but of the marvelous and the inexplicable, there is plenty. In our present state of knowledge, we have become more careful, more hesitating in our judgment in regard to the stories of the miraculous which we have received from antiquity, that the earth in its course stood still, that a she-ass spoke, that a storm was quieted by a word, we do not believe, and we shall never again believe, but that the lame walked, the blind saw, and the deaf heard will not be so summarily dismissed as an illusion," unquote. Harry Emerson Fosdick was one of the most popular and influential liberal pastors at the height of the fundamentalist-modernist controversy. In his book, The Modern Use of the Bible, Fosdick says, "Approaching the Bible so, there are some narratives of miracles there which I do not believe. To suppose that a man, in order to be a loyal and devout disciple of our Lord in the 20th century A.D., must think that God in the 9th century B.C. miraculously sent bears to eat up unruly children or made an axe head swim seems to me to be dangerously ridiculous. Folk who insist on that kind of literal inerrancy in ancient documents are not fundamentalists at all. They are incidentalists. Joshua making the sun stand still may be poetry, and the story of Jonah and the great fish may be parable. The miraculous aspects of the plagues of Egypt and the magic fall of Jericho's walls may be legendary heightening of historical events. The amazing tales of Elijah and Elisha may be largely folklore. And in the New Testament, finding a coin in a fish's mouth to pay the temple tax, or walking on water, or blasting a tree with a curse may be just such stories as always have been associated with an era of outstanding personalities and creative spiritual power. Certainly, I find some of the miracle narratives in Scripture historically incredible," unquote. Rudolf Bultmann, late professor of New Testament at the University of Marburg, has probably been the most influential New Testament scholar and theologian so far this century. In his book, Jesus Christ in Mythology, Bultmann writes, quote, "The whole conception of the world, which is presupposed in the preaching of Jesus, as in the New Testament generally, is mythological. That is, the conception of the world is being structured in three stories, heaven, earth, and hell, the conception of the intervention of supernatural powers in the course of events, and the conception of miracles, especially the conception of the intervention of supernatural powers in the inner life of the soul, the conception that men can be tempted and corrupted by the devil and possessed by evil spirits. This conception of the world we call mythological because it is different from the conception of the world which has been formed and developed by science since its inception in ancient Greece, which has been accepted by all modern men. In any case, modern science does not believe that the course of nature can be interrupted or, so to speak, perforated by supernatural powers," unquote. But if miracles don't occur, then the origin of life on Earth was not miraculous. Then there are only three non-miraculous alternatives. One, life has always existed on Earth. Two, it was brought here by natural means. Or three, it developed naturally on Earth. Since most agree that the Earth has not always existed, only the latter two are usually considered. The third alternative, it developed naturally on Earth, is clearly evolution, whether or not in its Darwinian form. As for the second alternative, if life was brought here by traveling spores or in spaceships, then it still had to originate somewhere, since the universe does not appear to be infinitely old either. Thus, some form of natural origin and development of life must be postulated anyway, and both the second and third alternatives reduce the evolution. To the extent, then, that liberal or modernist theology denies the miraculous, it simultaneously affirms the occurrence of evolution. To the extent that denial of the miraculous is a crucial part of theological liberalism, so is evolution, whatever part God may be viewed in playing in the evolutionary process. Theological liberalism is therefore rightly classified as an evolution religion. Evolution religion in the Bible. One need not be a theologian to realize that miracles form an important part of the biblical narrative. The creation account itself contains miracles. Israel's history begins with miracles surrounding the Exodus from Egypt and the giving of the law at Sinai. Christianity begins with Jesus' miracle-filled ministry, especially with his resurrection. As the Apostle Paul points out, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is worthless. You are still in your sins. 1 Corinthians 15:17. How then is theological liberalism related to the religion taught in the Bible? The fact is that theological liberalism is not biblical Christianity, whatever its historical roots in Christianity may be. Professor J. Gresham Machen of Princeton Seminary made this perfectly clear over 60 years ago. Quote, "In the sphere of religion in particular, the present time is a time of conflict. The great redemptive religion, which has always been known as Christianity, is battling against a totally diverse type of religious belief, which is only the more destructive to the Christian faith because it makes use of traditional Christian terminology. This modern non-redemptive religion is called modernism or liberalism. Both names are unsatisfactory. The latter in particular is question begging. The movement is designated liberalism is regarded as liberal only by its friends. To its opponents, it seems to involve a narrow ignoring of many relevant facts. And indeed, the movement is so various in its manifestations that one may almost despair of finding any common name which will apply to all its forms. But manifold as are the forms in which the movement appears, the root of the movement is one. The many varieties of modern liberal religion are rooted in naturalism, that is, the denial of any entrance of the creative power of God, distinguished from the ordinary course of nature, in connection with the origin of Christianity." Lest Dr. Machen be accused of bias in this regard, being a fundamentalist himself, we also quote Professor Kearsoff Lake of Harvard. Quote, "But it is a mistake, often made by educated persons who happen to have but little knowledge of historical theology, to suppose that fundamentalism is a new and strange form of thought. It is nothing of the kind. It is a partial and uneducated survival of a theology which was once universally held by all Christians. How many were there, for instance, in Christian searches in the 18th century who doubted the infallible inspiration of all Scripture? A few, perhaps, but very few. No, the fundamentalist may be wrong. I think he is. But it is we who have departed from the tradition, not he. I am sorry for the fate of anyone who tries to argue with a fundamentalist on the basis of authority. The Bible and the corpus theologicum of the Church is on the fundamentalist side," unquote. Theological liberalism thus relates to the Bible in two ways. In those cases where it agrees with biblical teaching, it accepts and uses the Bible. Elsewhere, it proceeds by explaining away biblical teaching as mythological, primitive, pre-scientific, figurative, or simply mistaken. In the case of the Genesis accounts of creation, several devices are employed. One, it is alleged that there are actually two creation accounts which contradict one another. Two, mythological elements borrowed from paganism are identified in the text. Three, the accounts in any case do not go back to God through Moses on Mount Sinai, but were written up by unknown authors hundreds of years later. Let us look briefly at each of these in turn. Two accounts of creation. Liberal theologians regularly identify two different creation accounts, one in Genesis 1:1, 3:2-4a, and the other in Genesis 2:4b through 25. Contradictions are then alleged between the two. For instance, Robert Davidson, author of the popular liberal commentary on Genesis 1-11 and the Cambridge Bible Commentary on the New English Bible, notes regarding Genesis 2, verses 5 and 6. Quote, "The picture of creation here is very different from that of Genesis 1 and the Babylonian creation epic. Instead of watery chaos, there is an arid, plantless, uninhabited wilderness." Unquote. Conrad Hyers is typical in claiming chronological discrepancy between the two chapters. Whereas Genesis 1 has creation in the order plants, animals, man, in Genesis 2, Adam is created before plants and animals, and Eve after. None of this is necessary. All these discrepancies depend upon the assumptions that Genesis 1 and 2 were originally two different documents, and that the editor who put them together was too stupid to notice the differences. In fact, however, as the two chapters stand in the creation account, Genesis 1 gives an overall view of creation from universe to man in an explicitly chronological order. Genesis 2, on the other hand, gives a detailed account of the creation of man, in which it is noted that Adam had a chance to learn for himself that he needed woman before God created her. There is no need to assume that either the plants or animals were created after Adam, nor that the watery chaos at the beginning of Genesis 1 refers to the same time period as the arid wilderness of Genesis 2. Mythology in Genesis. Liberal theologians have regularly seen myth in Genesis 1 and 2. Though there's a confusing variety of definitions of myth, they all include the idea that a myth is not historically reliable. Bernard Anderson speaks of the paradise story as mythical. Quote, "Taken by itself, the story is filled with images, like the tree of life and the cunning serpent, which are found in ancient folklore. Indeed, the story evidently once circulated as a storyteller's answer to several questions. Why are man and woman attracted to each other? Why does social propriety demand the wearing of clothes? Why must there be pain of childbirth and the misery of hard work? Why is the serpent hated by man?" Unquote. Davidson concurs, quote, "Some of the material in Genesis 1 through 11 may be handled as story myths. For example, the story of the garden, 2:5 to 3:24, the flood, chapter 6 through 8, the Tower of Babel, 11:1 through 9. Such stories may draw on fantasy, this is probably true of the story of the garden, or they may draw on fact," unquote. But Davidson also identifies another kind of myth, quote, "the spoken word which accompanied the performance of certain all-important religious rituals," unquote. Genesis 1:1 through 2:4 is seen as this kind of myth, a ritual protecting the worshippers from the dreaded return of primeval chaos. It is hard to know how to answer these charges. We cannot return to antiquity to learn if there actually was an Eden and a fall of mankind. Yet if biblical Christianity is true, we cannot afford to wait until we die to find out. We certainly have no evidence from the Bible that the ancient Hebrews ever acted out the creation account as some sort of ritual. Even if they did, that would not preclude its being a revelation from God, rather like baptism or the Lord's Supper. Genesis 2 can be read as a primitive attempt to answer various intriguing questions, but it presents itself as actual history. Serpents and trees or plants which give life can be found in pagan stories. Did the Bible borrow from them? They from the Bible? Or from some memory of what happened? Or is the resemblance accidental? After all, there are lots of animals and magical objects in folklore. We should not be surprised if some of them happen to coincide with biblical animals and objects. It has regularly been claimed that the biblical creation account was borrowed from the Babylonians ever since the Babylonian creation account of Numa Elish was discovered in the last century. The two accounts are actually drastically different. The Babylonian tale is a story of the origin of the gods and how Marduk became the chief god. creation is almost incidental to name Enuma Elish, which is mainly a war between the gods, but central to Genesis 1. The Bible is monotheistic, Enuma Elish polytheistic. Matter is eternal in the latter and created in the former. Man is an afterthought in the creation part of Enuma Elish, but the climax of God's creative activity in the Bible. Yet there are also some striking similarities, namely in the order in which the few overlapping topics are treated. Alexander Heidel lists these as follows. By the way, I don't agree with his identifications here in all details, but I give you his list. Enuma Elish on the one side, Genesis on the other. Enuma Elish has divine spirit and cosmic matter as coexistent and co-eternal. Genesis, divine spirit creates cosmic matter and exists independently. Enuma Elish has primeval chaos and the goddess Tiamat in darkness. Genesis has the earth a desolate waste and the darkness covering the deep. And a number of people have alleged that the term deep in Hebrew is related in some way to Tiamat. There certainly is some resemblance there. Enuma Elish follows with creation of firmament. Genesis has a creation of firmament. Enuma Elish has creation of dry land. Genesis follows with creation of dry land. Enuma Elish has creation of luminaries. Genesis has creation of luminaries. Enuma Elish has creation of man. Genesis has creation of man. Enuma Elish has the gods rest and celebrate. And Genesis has gods resting and sanctifying the seventh day. Some liberals explain these similarities and differences by suggesting the writer of Genesis intentionally used the Babylonian creation myth to show the contrast between Israel's God and the false gods. Perhaps he did. God might well have had Moses do something of the sort. Yet we suggest that God was also describing what really happened, as set out in our book Genesis 1 and the origin of the earth. There we have suggested an even stronger correlation between the events of Genesis 1 and the scientific sequence for the origin of the earth. Here we have another chart, biblical material, scientific theory. Biblical material, in the beginning, God created. Scientific evidence suggests a beginning, perhaps a big bang. Biblical material, the earth is without form and void. Scientific theory, with the origin of the solar system, the earth starts out in amorphous, tenuous nebula. In the Bible, we have the darkness upon the face of the deep. And in scientific theory, after this nebula contracts some, the cloud becomes dark within. Biblical material, the Spirit of God moves on the face of the waters. Scientists generally avoid references to God like the plague, unless they're selling popular books, but I suggest providential oversight with occasional intervention. Biblical material speaks then of God saying, "Let there be light." Scientific theory, further contraction causes the cloud to glow. Biblical account next, the light is divided from the darkness. The scientific theory, the planetary material is thrust outside of the glowing cloud in an equatorial band, and so an observer riding with this material would see light, the nebula itself, and darkness, the sky around. The Genesis account goes on to speak of light as being called day and darkness as being called night. This planetary material, according to scientific theory, would condense to form planetesimals and the sun, the planetesimals will condense to form the planets, and then the presence of the sun and the rotation of these planets will give a day-night sequence. The biblical material in Job speaks of water bursting forth from the womb of the earth, and in Genesis 1, of the appearance of the firmament in the midst of the waters. According to scientific theory, the earth is heated within after its formation by its own pressure, by radioactivity, and this drives out water and gases to produce the atmosphere and the oceans. Genesis account speaks of the division of waters above and below the firmament. In the scientific theory, the presence of the atmosphere allows both surface and atmospheric water. Genesis account goes on to mention the gathering of water and the appearance of dry land. In the scientific theory, continental material develops from suboceanic material by means of volcanism and erosion. Genesis account, we have the earth bringing forth vegetation, and it's not until you've got land that in the scientific theory you will have land vegetation appearing. Finally, the Genesis account speaks of lights appearing in the sky to mark off the days and the seasons, the sun to dominate the day and the moon to dominate the night. According to scientific evidence, the earth, when it's first formed, after the atmosphere has been pushed out from the inside, that you have a very cloudy situation, but that the vegetation begins a photosynthetic process which replaces the carbon dioxide with oxygen, clearing the atmosphere so that the sun, moon, and stars become visible, and also preparing the atmosphere for animals and man. It seems to me that no idea that Genesis is merely pagan mythology warmed over, or the guesses of ancient men, explains this correlation, which is substantially larger than the correlation between the Elish and the Genesis account. Multi-document theories. The third feature of liberal approach to the creation account involves the claim that the books of Genesis through Deuteronomy are not really the revelation of God to Moses. Instead, they are editorial interweaving of several much later sources, usually four, designated by the abbreviations J, E, D, and P. Though there are some significant differences among liberal scholars on the number, date, and extent of these sources, the usual view today is that the earliest was J, a Judean source that used the name Yahweh for God, and was written in the 10th century B.C. The second was E, so-called because it used the name Elohim for God, a northern or Ephraimite source written in 9th century B.C. The third, D, basically Deuteronomy, is dated to 7th century B.C. and connected with the reforms of King Josiah. The fourth source, P, so named because of its alleged priestly interests, is dated to the Babylonian exile or shortly thereafter. In Genesis 1 and 2, it is alleged that Genesis 1:1 through 2:4a is P's account of creation, and Genesis 2:4b to 25 is J's. The criteria used to prove the existence of these sources and separate them from one another include 1, different styles, 2, different names for God, and 3, repetitions, and 4, alleged inconsistencies within a particular account. Although almost universally accepted in liberal theological circles, the evidence for the existence of these documents is really quite weak. In responding to this type of theory, we can do no better than quote an article by Alan A. McCray, professor of Old Testament Biblical Theological Seminary, who has spent over 50 years researching the Old Testament and related areas. Dr. McCray notes, quote, "We have hundreds of manuscripts, copies, of the first 5 books of the Bible, all of which present them in the form in which we have them today. Not even one ancient copy of J, E, D, or P as a separate and continuous unit has ever been found. No record that has come down to us from ancient times contains any mention of these documents. There is no ancient reference to the writing of any such document or to such processes of combining them as the theory assumes. There is no evidence that any such process actually occurred." The theory is almost the lone survivor of a method of 19th century literary study that has otherwise been almost completely discarded except in the field of biblical criticism. A century ago, it was a common practice to develop theories of this type regarding almost any ancient or medieval document. Most such theories have today been abandoned and are viewed merely as literary curiosities. It is only in the field of biblical study that this 19th century attitude has been maintained. During the 19th century, various German scholars presented widely differing theories regarding the origin of the first 5 books of the Bible. No one of these theories gained complete ascendancy until 1878, when a particular theory, strikingly different from most of the views previously held, was advanced by Julius Wellhausen. This new theory was publicized throughout the English-speaking world by S.R. Driver and other followers of Wellhausen. Even though a century has passed, in the course of which no new evidence for the theory has been discovered, it is today being widely taught in almost the identical form in which it was then presented. A great part of the reason for the acceptance of the multi-document theory, advanced by Professor Wellhausen in 1878, was the fact that he based it upon his skillful presentation of a particular idea of the development of Israelite religion. This idea, however, has now been almost universally discarded. Few scholars today hold to a theory of Hebrew religious development that is even approximately similar to that upon which Wellhausen based his idea of the sources of the Pentateuch. And yet Wellhausen's method of dividing these alleged sources and his view of the order of their composition, although based upon a theory of development no longer held, are still being presented as established fact. An essential feature of the theory, as taught by Professor Wellhausen, was his claim that the various documents, all of them written according to the theory long after the time of the patriarchs, present only the thought patterns and ideas of the various periods in which they were alleged to be written, and tell us nothing about the actual time of the patriarchs. In the light of archaeological discoveries, it is now recognized that this attitude is no longer tenable. Therefore, most of the recent presentations of the theory assert that a great part of the material in each of the documents was transmitted orally for many centuries before being incorporated in written form, and even the latest of the documents contains much material that is really early. Thus, an important basis of the Wellhausen idea has really been abandoned by its present promoters. Its protagonists assert that the theory can be demonstrated by pointing out differences of style between the documents. Yet these alleged differences in style mostly settle down to the fact that certain parts of the Pentateuch are statistical or enumerative, while other parts have more of a running narrative style, and the greater part of the book of Deuteronomy consists of exhortation. There is no reason why the same writer should not use any one of these styles, depending on the nature of the particular subject matter. Thus, we have an enumerative style in Genesis 1, where the formation of the material universe is set forth in definite stages. For the subject matter of Genesis 2, which describes in more detail the creation of man and the formation of a proper habitat for his life, the narrative style is more fitting. In addresses of warning and admonition, the style of exhortation is natural. Similar instances of the use of styles, at least as different as these, could be found in the works of almost any extensive writer of recent days. It is frequently said that the names given to two of these documents are based upon the allegation that the so-called J document uses the name, we'll pronounce it Yahweh, Lord in the King James Version, for the deity, while the so-called E document is said to use the name Elohim, God, in the King James Version. Yet actually, each of these alleged sources uses both divine names in the Pentateuch, and in all of the alleged sources, the name Yahweh is far more common than the name Elohim. In explanation, supporters of the theory assert that according to the E and P documents, the name Yahweh was not revealed until the early chapters of Exodus. The theory is thus not that each document preferred a certain name, but that each document had a different theory as to when the name was first introduced and deliberately avoided it before that point in the account. Since all the documents are alleged to have been written many centuries after the time of the Exodus, procedure such as the theory assumes would be artificial and rather unlikely to have occurred. Furthermore, its foundation in biblical statements is extremely weak. Moreover, the use of varying names in different connections is not at all unusual and can easily be explained on other grounds than that of a patchwork origin. The claim that there is constant duplication of material in the various alleged sources is grossly exaggerated. Some of these so-called duplicates are really different events that are somewhat similar, but actually no more so than is often the case in ordinary life. This can be demonstrated fairly easily. In other cases, an alleged repetition is merely a summary given at the beginning or end of an account, a helpful recapitulation, or a literary device to make the account more vivid. Most of the alleged repetitions or duplications, examined without prejudice, can be shown to have a natural purpose in the narrative. Most of the alleged contradictions between the so-called sources disappear on careful examination. Thus, it is alleged that the J and P documents exhibit Rebekah as influenced by different motives in suggesting Jacob's departure from Canaan, the motive being in one case to enable him to escape his brother's anger, and in the other case to induce him to procure a wife agreeable to his parents' wishes. Actually, there is no contradiction whatever in supposing that Rebekah was influenced by both motives, and that in dealing with the two men whom she wished to influence, Jacob and Isaac, she used in each case the argument that she knew would appeal to him rather than the one that would be asked to antagonize him. So far, Dr. McCray. Here again, there is no need to accept the liberal argumentation that the Genesis accounts could not have been written by Moses on the basis of God's revelation. Is evolution religion true? In the preceding sections, we've examined the form of evolution religion, which played a significant part in McLean versus Arkansas creation evolution trial, namely theological liberalism. We concentrated on the Protestant form of theological liberalism, though there are considerable similarities in the Catholic and Jewish story. We have suggested that this form of religion is not that actually taught by the Bible. Instead, it dismisses any biblical statements that conflict with its own theology by treating them as figurative on a statement. Of course, liberal theology agrees with the Bible on some points, but this could be said of any world religion. Yet the most important question for us to consider is not whether evolution, religion, and the Bible agree, but since they don't, which is right? Why should one be worried about agreement with the Bible if it is only the guesswork of ancient men and not the very word of the living God? Likewise, why should one be worried about agreement with this particular form of evolution religion if it is only the guesswork of modern men? It is our understanding of the relevant evidence that the statements of the Bible and the facts of science agree when interpreted within an older creationist framework, though not within either a younger creationist or liberal theological framework. That the Bible is to be accepted as God's revelation to mankind is evidenced in numerous ways. Let us sketch a few of them for you. One, the universe itself gives every indication that it has not always existed, but came into existence at some finite time in the past. This is most naturally understandable in terms of a miraculous creation. Two, the structure of the universe, and especially of the earth, seems particularly designed for life and for man. Those who see no source of planning in the universe are hard put to explain this. Three, the enormously detailed organization of life speaks strongly against its origin and development by purely natural processes, or at least by unguided natural processes. Christians have a working model for such organization, namely the organizing power of a mind. Evolutionists have not been able to get their model, high-level organization through random processes, to work, even though numerous computer simulations have been attempted. Four, the fossil record is so largely filled with gaps that most evolutionists are now looking for rapid change in small populations as the mode of evolution, rather than gradual change in large populations. Yet trying to find a naturalistic mode for rapid evolution raises even more problems than for gradual evolution. This gap phenomenon rather suggests that God has intervened at various times in history to create new kinds, rather than all these transitions occurred rapidly. Five, the Bible claims to be written by the God who made all things. Though considerable dispute surrounds the interpretation of its statements of origins, few would deny that it fits the observed features described in the preceding four paragraphs. Few would deny that the Bible claims the universe came into existence at a finite time in the past, that it was designed for life and for man, that it is enormously detailed, and that it would fit something where there are gaps in the fossil record. Six, the Bible also claims that its divine author controls history and knows the end from the beginning, so that he can and does predict the future. It contains numerous excellent examples of detailed fulfillments occurring centuries after they were predicted. Seven, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus contain numerous striking miracles, which are attested by excellent historical evidence. Eight, biblical Christianity has shown a unique power for two millennia to transform the lives of those who trust in Jesus as their Savior from sin. No other world religion can compete in this area, certainly not theological liberalism. These lines of evidence indicate that evolution religion, as we have described it, is mistaken in regard to the nature of God, his connection with the Bible, and the mode of his activity in history. The exclusion of this evidence from public education under what seems to be an erroneous interpretation of the First Amendment has surely been a significant factor contributing to our present moral decline and national loss of nerve. The decision in the case of McLean versus Arkansas continues the situation and effectively favors the propagation of secular humanism and theological liberalism at public expense. It does not bode well for the future of our nation unless significant changes take place. Okay, I'll be willing to make some stab at some questions here. Got Dr. McCray in the audience in case any questions come up on the JDP theory or any of those areas. Any questions? Yes, correct.
What kind of action do you personally favor in terms of what Christians can do to try to forestall the change of following up your last statement?
Yes. I think several things have been done already are moves in the right direction, though perhaps not everything is being done quite right. I think if nothing else can be done, a desire to have a Christian educational system, if it has to be a private one with no tuition vouchers or anything, so be it. I think one can make an argument for tuition vouchers as a fair way of proceeding. Obviously, there's a very strong public education lobby that would be antagonistic to that. I personally feel that the structure of education in our public schools, not just in science, but in areas such as history and sociology and government and various other things, is strongly biased towards a secular humanism of some sort, and that at least reasonably encompasses theological liberalism. I feel that that could be more balanced without running the other extreme and teaching young earth creationism on the one hand and atheistic evolution on the other hand and not discussing any of the other alternatives. I feel that that was a problem that seemed to be implied in the Arkansas law, though the persons who defended it denied that that was really the case there. My suggestion would be that you can construct two alternative general models of origins. One is everything has occurred naturally. There's been no supernatural intervention anywhere. And the other model is, yes, there has been supernatural intervention somewhere. Let's see where in the scientific evidence something of that sort might be implied, and to operate with that kind of a two-model program in the public schools as something that is not per se religious, unless one wants to define the possibility of supernatural religious. I think that's part of the bias that exists in modern discussions of the First Amendment, that any reference to supernatural is suddenly religious, not realizing that there are lots of naturalistic religions which are thereby favored if the discussion is ignored and everything is treated as purely naturalistic. That would be the direction I would suggest going then, without saying, well, we get this from the Bible, or that there ought to be this age for the earth or something. They can look at those questions, but not construct it in such a way that a Mohammedan might feel that his possible views have been not allowed any place or anything of that sort. So that'd be my suggestion there. Further questions or comments? I think Christians should certainly be interested in that. I've not followed it carefully enough to know the exact difference between the Louisiana and the Arkansas wording, although from what I've heard, the Louisiana wording is less easily objected to than the Arkansas wording is. I better not say anything about that. I certainly think that that we could have a bad situation if some attempt is not made to, on the one hand, allow a somewhat balanced presentation in the public schools, or on the other hand, the other presentation has to be specifically aligned with a particular religion, which is certainly going to raise trouble in a society that views itself as pluralistic, I suppose. But I think we've got a very unbalanced situation today where religion is almost not mentioned in public. I was speaking with a scientist just recently who wondered why it was in this country that God was never mentioned in public. It was very different in the country he had come from. And it seems to me it's partially this mishandling of the First Amendment that is responsible for that, that somehow you're violating somebody's privacy or freedom of religion if you mention God in public. I think that's a very false way of representing the matter that produces a very bad imbalance the other way. Further. Yes, Ken.
See, I'm trying to explain what I'm thinking. It seems that, as much as I know that oftentimes theological divisions have gone along with philosophical divisions, and they've gone from a very extroverted, very rationalistic stream on one hand, and the swing to a rather irrational, almost introspective stream on the other, and that religion follows the course of philosophy. Currently, particularly because of the strength of science, the current philosophy is very rationalistic. I'd almost prefer reason the rationalistic to the extent we use naturalistic. The rationalistic is probably something really different. But religion is not really a rational function. And because of the strength of science and rational thinking primitive, that religion somewhat was imposed upon. And I wonder if it's not almost a psychological strain that's taking place rather than anything that's really overt on sort of a theological level. You know, rather than argue on the basis of reason, one has to consider more irrational aspects of humanity and obviously that's.
Well, I'd certainly admit that humanity has considerable element of the irrational about it. It seems to me, though, that can be a lumping term that confuses some things that are very important and very different. I think the Bible would represent that sin is basically irrational in the long run, and therefore I do not think biblical Christians would want their views lumped as irrational along with all the other religions of the world, or at least a good hunk of them, and treat that as the categories. One of the big problems you get in any area of trying to solve a problem is trying to decide which categorizations really help clarify the problems and which categorizations muck things up. I personally think representing religion as irrational and Christianity as an example of it messes things up in the long run. It depends quite a bit, though, on how you define rational. Part of the trouble, I think, is rationalism. The opposite of rationalism is not irrationality. The opposite of irrationality is rationality. I would say Christianity is rational
in the sense that it says God created the mind, it's to be used, and it is a way by which we determine truth. The difference, I think, would be that there are many people in the world who believe that all that needs to be known, or all that can surely be known by mankind, can only be determined by mankind's own experimentation. And others that believe that, in fact, there are beings or a being who is outside the universe in some sense, and who is conveyed to us information we need to know by means of revelation. And I would say that is the view of biblical Christianity. And so a denial that there is any such need or any such thing puts one in loggerheads with biblical Christianity. Now, that there is good evidence for the Bible being more than the guesses of ancient men, I think there's excellent support for that, but that's obviously something that has to be argued. We've merely referred to it here and then given you a bibliography to look at some things in that direction. You're certainly right that religion has a tendency to move with philosophy, and that both of them have a tendency to swing back and forth over the ages. Surely that's the case. I think here then Christianity sometimes finds itself shooting at opponents on the left and sometimes finds itself shooting at opponents on the right, but most of the time there are plenty on both sides, both shooting at Christianity and we shooting back. So there's enough of that. I think it would be a mistake, one which I think at least is a borderline problem in young earth creationism, of denying the very processes by which you find out things about the universe, or not at least testing them in a very careful way. I feel there's a real problem in that direction. There is, however, another problem, which I've seen in a number of books I've been reading and some interaction with a number of scientists, and that is viewing science as a program to explain everything naturalistically. I certainly have run into many scientists that way. It's not necessarily true of all scientists, but it's certainly a theme that shows up very strongly in science. That program is a good one if, in fact, everything can be explained naturalistically, and by explain mean actually telling how it happened. It's naturally a rather bad program if, in fact, they're wrong about that, and if, in fact, anything significant to human history, anything significant to the existence of the universe, actually depends upon events which cannot be explained in terms of purely natural laws. I try to suggest in a number of my works that the origin of the universe itself and that the origin of life both seem to fall in those categories, and at least no one has models that clearly work for both of those. And then I've tried to suggest, and came in, up in this paper as well, that there are evidences in the Bible that the picture it gives of origins actually fits the kind of things we see going on, though admittedly there's a lot of controversy over how to interpret the various materials. Trying to figure out some division that can be worked in a pluralistic society may be quite a different problem than trying to decide what you're going to teach in your church. But to me, just to be fair, some kind of thing that allows the possibility of the supernatural in a discussion of origins is at least more likely to encompass truth than one that removes one of the possibilities and discusses only the other because one is science and the other is religion. I think that would be a serious problem. And I think we've got that serious problem. I wander away here. Sorry about that. Questions shouldn't wander me off into 5 or 10 minutes of talking. But further questions?
So who teaches new mode of creation science in the public schools? And if you have a biologist who teaches evolution, he's not going to convert himself over to talking about creation science. God created Earth, he's not going to say that. He's not a Christian or believing the Bible. So how are you going to break that? It sounds like to me that maybe they'll throw evolution out of schools and then they won't have anything like it.
Hard to say what they do. I think that in principle, it is possible for a person to teach alternative views about something, even though he fairly strongly feels one of them is right and fairly strongly feels the other is wrong. It's probably nearly impossible for him to teach them so that the students can't figure out what he believes. But I think at least a student who feels that he's out to lunch on what he believes will at least feel that if he gives a fair shake to the other one, they're at least getting a range of views of the matter. I think we've had a problem throughout history, and I don't know that there's a complete solution to it, that a teacher tends to teach what he believes, naturally, what you expect. But the problem could partially be solved, perhaps, by saying, well, let the professors teach what they believe, or better, I feel, let the professors try and give a view of the evidence in the whole area, and then let the students try and figure out what is the case. And their own personal views can certainly come up, but they ought still give some time to the other. Naturally, I think many of us feel that a presentation of creation and evolution by a teacher who thought creationists were complete idiots and that evolutionists were really headed all together, might be more harmful than a presentation in which only the evolution was presented, but it might not. Students, like all humans, are rather stubborn persons. And if they hear something dumped upon, they might at least investigate it. Whereas if they never hear anything said about it, they won't. In fact, as far as I know, it's not the case that nothing is being said about it, however. Most books I have looked at make some remark to the effect, back 1,000 years ago, everybody believed the Earth was 4,000, 6,000 years old, 5,000 years old, I guess it would have been back 1,000 years ago, and now we know better, etc. You get those kind of sort of slams stuck in here and there all over the place. And whereas I think the young Earth creationist view is mistaken, I still think it's somewhat gratuitous to kind of dump on a view that is widely accepted in society when you are being hired by the taxpayers to teach the course. Now, if you're running your own private college, you can kind of do what you want. You could teach Kung Fu or Unity School of Christianity or Sung Myung Moon's position or whatever you want for private school. For public school, it seems to me there's some public responsibility. And that public responsibility has two poles, trying to teach what you think is the truth and trying to see that the views of society are moderately representative in that. And, there is a tension there, obviously so. But that tension may go back all the way to the question of whether the First Amendment is consistent with public education. Is it possible to have public education without, in effect, establishing one religion? It's an interesting question. Don't know the answer to it. Hasn't been tried too hard, I would say, recently. Further questions? Yes.
So if the student's involvement who still deny that they hear from the try to backline the way that say that Christ actually lived in history and died and rose again, so they do see some supernatural, are they still fitting in the evolution religion or could they be creationists?
I have yet to see a student of Boltmann, but there must be some, who believe that Jesus actually rose again. Now, of course, there may be some students of Boltmann who reject his whole position, but the post-Boltmannian school does not believe in the resurrection. So, as far as I can tell, they still have no place for the supernatural, and people far more moderate than they in liberal theological circles still have no place for the resurrection as an actual event that took place in history. Barth himself, much more moderate man than Boltmann in many ways, was asked by Carl Henry at a press conference, if a newspaper reporter had been at the tomb on Easter morning, would he have anything to report? And Barth, like many modern churchmen, cleverly sidestepped the question without giving an answer to the matter.
What about
Hornbaum?
He
never says. What you've got to realize is that theological liberalism of the denominational sort, that is, the guys that still bother to teach in seminaries, still are involved in the denomination, etc., believes in, quote, the resurrection in the sense that Jesus still exists, but not in the sense that he ever got his body back. Most of them do not believe that our eternal state has anything to do with bodies. They tend to be immortality of the soul people if they believe in survival. And at least your older liberalism did believe in the survival of personality beyond death, but that it's all there in heaven somewhere, etc. Well, that's not what the Bible would represent by resurrection, but many liberals do believe that sort of thing. I wonder whether Boltmann even believes that, but I'd be inclined to think that perhaps Barth and doubtless some other of the liberal theologians do believe that. Further. Okay.